good horse, I call you my shiny black bear.
Conquest, untrammeled force, become systematized, and thus frame not as a predatory relation, but as a moral one, with lords providing protection and villagers their sustenance.
From somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy midnight, you snort my good pony and you give me your.
You're listening to episode 582 of Unwelcome Guests, The Cargo Cult of Money. I'm Robin Upton. And that quote, of course, from David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years, with which we ended last episode. And I'm repeating them now as a kind of a touchstone, because I think this is one of the many very important points that Graeber makes in his book. The financial overclass, the money masters, have effectively insinuated their way into people's thinking and worked very hard to try to legitimize their predatory relationship with all the users of their money system. Living in Bangladesh as I do, a common question is people asking, is Britain a Christian country? And I have to say no, the number of Christians is actually very small, and I say that the religion is money. Money decides what's good and bad, it decides what people do. It provides a lot of people with a motivation. Heaven, of course, in financial terms, completely unreachable, because however much money you've got, you can always have more. Now, this week on the show, we're going to continue reading David Graeber's book. We'll finish chapter 5 and start on chapter 6. We're also going to hear another 15 minutes from Edward Griffin about the creation of that most powerful of American institutions, the Federal Reserve. And we're going to start with monologuist Mike Daisy from KPFA's Against the Grain. Now, he takes my analogy of money as being like a religion one step further. This is from February 2011. And the interviewer is C.S. Soong, to whom many thanks for this interview.
Daisy is in Berkeley to perform two new monologues. The last, Cargo Cult, is about the global economic collapse, about the religion, he calls it a religion, of finance, and about what money does to human relationships. His other show, The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, is about our obsession with electronic gadgetry and where those gadgets come from. He's performing both monologues at Berkeley Repertory Theater. When I sat down recently with Mike Daisy in our KPFA Berkeley studios, I began by asking him what a cargo cult is.
Well, a cargo cult is a term used by anthropologists that basically refers to a set of conditions where cultures that are less technologically advanced, generally in the South Pacific, when encountering more technologically advanced cultures, sometimes have this massive transformative experience when the technology appears that seems so wondrous and does so much that they begin to worship the objects which appear to, you know, have come from across the seas and give no sign of how it is that they've been produced, because human beings often worship power. Religions spring up around those objects, especially when the people who brought the objects leave.
And what objects are worshipped by the people on the island that you visited in the South Pacific? I think it's called Tana.
Yeah, Tana. It's really the whole arc of objects, you know, refrigerators, televisions, pictures. Pictures of people are connected to the people themselves. So there's a whole sort of animus running through all the objects. They're seen as part and parcel of sort of human exchange and human behavior. So really, really everything, really any object, even though technology is on the island now, of course, and people use it day to day, that doesn't change the sort of core precepts of this religion that on Tana is called the John Frum movement. They await the day that John Frum will come from over the seas and bring cargo in his hands.
And what's the origin of this cult on this particular island? What products, what cultures were these people exposed to?
Well, you know, primarily they were raised in a sort of a colonial context where the islands, which are now called Vanuatu, were called the New Hebrides, and they were ruled by the French and English ruling together on the islands and treating the islanders fairly brutally and attempting to indoctrinate them into money and ownership and to cause them to be integrated into the life of the colonials who were there. They revolted against this in large degree because they had outlawed the custom, the way of life that they had used that does not use money. And that war on the island back and forth sort of formed a fertile foundation, which then developed into this John Frum movement, which really centered around the idea that the same technology that comes from overseas that's being used to oppress the people could be used as a tool and a weapon to allow them to find their own freedom. In many ways, it's the same deal we make with technology every day, where we espouse very humanist values. Most people asked would say, you know, they want to have a good family, they want to have friends, they want to be well-fed, they want a peaceful life. But we also believe that we need a huge amount of technology to meet those ends. And to a large extent, we're often right. And technology can be used to ameliorate a lot of pain. And so on the island, they want the technology, even though to a large extent, it's the modern world that disrupts the way of life that they used to have.
And in what sense is a cargo cult about power, about desiring a kind of power?
Oh, it's almost entirely about that. And in the monologue I'm performing, really I'm talking about two cargo cults. And one is the cargo cult on this island of Tana and the celebrations they have there at the base of an erupting volcano where they tell the history of America. One day a year they have the celebration where they tell it all in dance, theater, and song. It's that cargo cult. And then it's also our cargo cult, which I would argue is finance as the dominant religion of our time.
And a religion in what sense? In what sense do we worship money and material things in a way that correlates with, say, religious observation, religious commitment?
It's a direct correlation. I mean, it's not a metaphor or an analogy. Finance is our religion. You know, anyone listening who functions in the society we live in, that's their religion. They are not Christians or Jews or atheists. They are believers in the financial system. As a religious construct, like all religions, it demands faith and trust. And in fact, our financial systems are built on that. If we don't believe in our financial systems, then we would not be submissive to them. And they rely on us believing in them for them to work their magic and dictate the terms of our world. It's exactly like a religion. It uses the same tropes that religions have always used. And we're very dedicated in a deep and sacred way to supporting it and keeping that system in place. It's exactly synonymous with religion.
In the monologue, The Last Cargo Cult, you say something like, money insulates a person from other people. What do you mean by that?
Well, the purpose of money, one of its purposes, is to be liquid power. And power always insulates us. We can use power to separate ourselves from the consequences of our actions and to make our lives easier. I mean, one of the reasons we all like money so much is because it affords us the power to do what we want, whatever we can afford. We like that. I know I like that. It's very seductive. And it's only by looking at our own personal behaviors that it starts to become clear how, on such a massive scale, the systems work the way they do across the whole world. The monologue deconstructs the international financial crisis of a few years ago and tries to explore how, if you think about it as a religious construct and you think about it a system of dominance and submission, it all makes very clear sense how we end up in the situation we are in today.
But couldn't power in one form or another, couldn't power bind us to other people? Couldn't it create bonds that grow stronger?
No. I mean, at the end of the day, the oldest aphorism is true. Power corrupts. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. Power always corrupts, but, you know, it's a necessity to go through life with some kind of power. You need at least the power to feed yourself and to continue to exist. And so each and every one of us, especially living in the culture we're embedded in, has to make complex ethical choices about what it means to make the amount of money we make and what end we are going to use that money toward and how we can leave this earth having felt as though we have walked an ethical path is an incredibly complex thing. And I believe most people in our context, living inside our culture, actually do not think about this. They may think about whether they are doing more good or enough good, but I do not think many people really wrestle with the fact that money inherently corrupts. All of it does. And so you're already working from a deficit. Like you're already working from a place where it's necessary to really think through, you know, the consequences of all the things you do. It's very tough.
And why don't we think through that? Is it because it would be too painful? It would reveal too many embarrassing or shameful things about ourselves?
In large part. I mean, I think it's very painful to actually reckon with the way the world actually works. I think it's very difficult to understand how much of the world depends on one person holding another person down with a pointed rock, and how that model has not appreciably changed that much in the hundreds and thousands of years of human civilization. I think that's tough, you know? And it's one of the reasons the shows rely on humor so much, because the response that you can have, the only response you can often have to the absurdity and horror of the life we live in is to laugh. And so, you know, in large part, I think we are resistant to looking into that dark place because it's tough.
And the shows are very funny. The two monologues are The Last Cargo Cult and The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, performed and written by Mike Daisy, currently at Berklee Repertory Theater through February 27th. This is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Mike Daisy joins us in our KPFA Berklee studios. There is money, and there's also all kinds of financial instruments, stocks, bonds, derivatives, credit default swaps, things called CDOs. What's important to understand about the levels of abstraction that accompany the formation and use of these kinds of things?
Well, it's important to understand that with each transaction, we engage in a sort of game of abstraction, and that's what makes it possible for power to flow back and forth to make commerce as it exists happen. But there's a steady drive to make our money more and more abstract because the people who manipulate that money, corporations and financial institutions, it really behooves them for their own gain to make the transactions as abstract as possible, and as they get more abstract, larger, so that the total marketplaces become bigger and bigger as you sort of move up the scale of abstraction from simple banks to bonds to stocks, you know, as you move all the way up to derivatives, things become more and more abstract until they're not really tied to any specific thing. And a lot of the consequences of the financial crisis and the real estate bubble are tied to specifically this, to assets being cut up and divided into tranches and mixed together as though everything is the same. But in fact, originally, each of those abstract pieces of paper were tied to an actual piece of land that has an actual house on it. And the decision to treat them all as though they were simply investments in a ledger is a huge part of why we find ourselves still embroiled in the mess we're in today.
Well, and I think you refer to this in your monologue, what happens to rational people once the level of abstraction gets so high and the numbers get so high that they become very difficult to grasp?
Well, yes, the numbers become irrational. You know, the world market for derivatives at the time of the almost crash was $126 trillion. I mean, that number is so huge, it has no rational frame of reference. And so the rational people, after a certain point, begin to check out of the process. They sort of leave and they sort of say like, oh, I don't know what this means. I have no idea. I'm sure there are experts who will tell you. I'm sure that there's bankers and people from Wall Street and that they can take care of this. And one of the problems is people don't realize fully that everyone in that system is in that system for a reason. They're in that system to be paid. Like, those people are on the take. Like, it behooves them to tilt the boards. So when the rational people opt out of the system, any chance of things being run in a rational manner begins to diminish quickly.
We've been talking about Mike Daisy's monologue, The Last Cargo Cult. I want to get to The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. But first, When did you first get the sense that you could not only perform monologues, but that you could do it for an occupation?
Well, I did the first monologue in 1997, and it was very clear from the very first one that this was something I'd be dedicating my life to. I'd performed a lot on stage, and I had written my whole life, and I've been looking for a form that united those things together, and it was very, very clear immediately that I'd struck on something that I needed to explore fully. And, you know, it wasn't clear whether it would be economically viable, but it wasn't until the third monologue, which was about my time working at Amazon.com, it really struck a nerve because the culture was going through the dot-com boom and bust right at the moment that I began doing the monologue. And really it was the momentum from that that allowed me to reach the kind of audience where today, you know, I've been working as a monologuist and as a working artist full-time for more than a decade.
Mike Daisy's monologues include Great Men of Genius, If You See Something, Say Something, 21 Dog Years, and All Stories Are Fiction, and he's currently performing two of his monologues, The Last Cargo Cult and The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, at Berkeley Repertory Theater through February 27th. For information and tickets, you can click on the link we've provided on againstthegrain.org or call 510-647-2949. That's 510-647-2949. Mike, I guess one possible way to explain what your current theatrical project is to say that, well, if Mike Daisy wrote a dry academic treatise about who's making electronics or what's behind the economic crisis, very few people might read it. And so if the information can be kind of filled out with stories and personal adventures and a lot of comedy, then it goes down easier than the pill becomes a lot easier to swallow. So I guess that's one possible explanation, but is it the correct one?
No. I mean, I think that's a common explanation, but I think the one I adhere to more, I think, is the idea that, well, first, the shows are not written, so they're created extemporaneously in the air each night over and over again with the audience who's there that night. And only that audience hears that specific story. They always shift and change over time. And I think there's incredible value to having an experience in the theater that is actually live. So the live people in the theater have a person speaking to them who is live, who's not working from a script, who's telling an actual story from their own life of the things they have actually seen. I believe that act of witnessing is very powerful. And I believe that working in the theater, despite the fact that I cannot reach as many people each time, the people I do reach, I have the possibility of reaching them in a deep way. And that is the promise and the hope that causes me to work within this idiom.
Now, The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, which is a separate monologue, you're doing these two monologues on different nights at Berkeley Rep. This is also about a blind spot, whereas The Last Cargo Cult was about money and blind spots about what money is and what goes into the fact that money has value. In the case of the Steve Jobs play, what is the blind spot? Who can't see and what can't they see?
Well, it's about, it's really two braided stories that weave against each other. One is about Steve Jobs and his rise and fall and rise within the tech industry, and about the idea that in our time, if we control the metaphor through which people see the world right at this point now, then you actually control the world itself. And it's about the war going on for the controlling of that framing in our networks and our devices. The other thread of the show is largely about that blind spot. The other thread is about where these devices come from. And it's about my journey to southern China, to Shenzhen, the city where almost all of our electronics come from, and a sort of expose on the circumstances under which those devices are made.
You planted yourself at the gates of a huge factory in Shenzhen and waited for workers to come out so you could talk with them. What was that experience like?
It was terrifying. The guards were really grim looking, and they had guns. And it'd been very clear, you know, my Google News alerts had let me know that first a Reuters reporter and an AP photographer in the weeks before I made my journey had each been detained, and one of them had been beaten and held for 2 days before being released. You know, in the special economic zone there in Shenzhen that the Chinese government set up to entice corporations around the world to come to, the law is secondary to the law of the corporations. The corporations rule that place with an iron fist. And so, and let's all be clear that those are our corporations. Like, we enabled that zone to exist, and we worked with a fascist government run by thugs. Like, we chose to do that. And so the situations that exist there are grim and frightening, and very few people visit. Very few Americans who are not businessmen complicit in the system actually go to Shenzhen. It's a really harrowing thing to go into a country knowing that you are there to do something that that government is opposed to. It really changes your relationship to the trip entirely.
And you stood out a bit too, huh?
Well, yes. You know, I am large, and I wear Hawaiian shirts, and I don't blend in. There's no attempt to blend in because it's really not going to work out.
And people obviously should go and see The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs in order to get more information. But can you share a little bit about what you learned about how workers in Shenzhen live and work?
Well, you know, the easiest way to express it, the clearest way, is for people to understand that all of their electronics, every last thing they use every day, is constructed under circumstances that involve horrific manual labor by people who are worked to death, literally. I mean, I witnessed people being worked to death over and over again. They should understand that the people sleep in 10-foot by 10-foot cement cells that have 13, 14, 15 beds stacked up on top of each other. There are cameras watching them every minute of the day. They're serfs. There's not that much difference between what I saw there and what you would see in a labor camp during World War II. I would challenge people to point out the differences between that system of slave labor used in the Second World War and what I saw in Shenzhen, including child labor, a huge amount of 14, 13, and 12-year-olds who are constructing all of our electronics that you use every day. And there are no electronics that are not made this way in our current system. And our corporations are currently completely exempt from U.S. labor law, despite the fact that they then import all of these devices here, brand them as their own, and distribute them to the American people. There's no culpability whatsoever.
When you asked these workers at the Shenzhen factories why they worked there, did the answer come back inevitably, economic necessity, I have to do this because this pays me more than any other job, or were there other responses?
Oh, no. Generally, getting to work in the special economic zone, people fought hard to get those jobs. They had to work very hard to get there. That's part of what makes the whole situation so appalling. You'll actually see this online, people responding to this monologue. People will say, it's so much worse in the villages of China. We should get a medal for all that we're doing. We made these jobs possible. The horrifying thing is that made possible nothing. We exported jobs without exporting any of our values. There's no reason why people need to actually work to death on these lines. There's no reason why people can't find basic medical attention. The situation rarely has to do even with profitability. Like, the cost of most of the labor reforms doesn't actually cost money. It's not so much an issue of money as it is humanity. The people are worked as though they are machines and as though their lives have no value. And we should also understand that Shenzhen, the special economic zone, exists in the south of China as a honey trap that we assisted the Chinese government in creating so that their brightest people are drawn down there, so they are kept busy making our stuff so that they will not cause trouble for the Chinese government. Like, it's very clear that that's part of the design of it, and we're all very complicit with that.
We assume that the electronic gadgets we use are made in factories by machines and automated processes. Do we assume correctly?
No, no. In fact, almost every piece of electronics is made by hand. Almost everything you touch in your life is made by hand in Chinese factories. There's very little mechanization in it, aside from the fact that the humans making it move in a mechanized manner. Every single telephone, if you pop off the back and look at the circuitry, the tracers and that the weld points between one section and another were all done by hand. The world is filled with handmade objects. Every LED on every piece of electronics that shines. I've been to LED plants. There are workers there laying in the tiny filaments by hand, one after another. There's a huge amount of hand labor that's going into everything we make, and we've divorced ourselves from that so that we do not even understand where the objects are coming from. And because we are so divorced from it, no one currently feels responsible for the situation, the circumstances under which people work. And without any degree of awareness, we can't start actually making humane workplaces.
Well, of course, I applaud Mike Daisy's desire to see humane workplaces, which I think is almost universal to the human species. We don't like to think of other people sweating in basically slave labor conditions, but a desire on its own is not enough. Much more praiseworthy is his ability to get on a plane and do some research. It's not difficult. It does require doing what you've not been told to do by the corporate programmed media, and I expect he still uses computer electronics devices made by such slave laborers, but he doesn't do so thoughtlessly. It requires a willingness. If you're going to lift up that dark stone, that dark corner of capitalism, and a willingness that you're going to face the results. Now, maybe you're wondering in your life whether to go for something or whether to stick with business as usual and not rock the boat. Well, the capitalist business as usual boat is on the rocks anyway. I would encourage you to follow your heart and do what you think is the right thing, not perhaps necessarily the most financially rewarding thing. Get outside that system of right and wrong, which is programmable by the money masters. And now let's conclude that chapter, the second half of David Graeber's brief treatise on the morality of economic relations. Conquest, untrammeled force, becomes systematized, and thus framed not as a predatory relation, but as a moral one, with lords providing protection and villagers their sustenance. But even if all parties assume they are operating by a shared moral code, that even kings cannot do whatever they want but must operate within limits, allowing peasants to argue about the rights and wrongs of just how much of their harvest the king's retainers are entitled to carry off, they are very unlikely to frame their calculation in terms of the quality and quantity of protection provided, but rather in terms of the custom and precedent. How much did we pay last year? How much did our ancestors have to pay? The same is true on the other side. If charitable donations become the basis for any sort of social relation, it will not be one based on reciprocity. If you give some coins to a panhandler, and that panhandler recognizes you later, it's unlikely that he'll give you any money, but he might well consider that you're more likely to give him money again. Certainly this is true if one donates money to a charitable organization. I gave money to the United Farm Workers once, and I still haven't heard the end of it. Such an act of one-sided generosity is treated as a precedent for what will be expected afterward. It's quite the same if one gives candy to a child. This is what I mean when I say that hierarchy operates by a principle that is the very opposite of reciprocity. Whenever the lines of superiority and inferiority are clearly drawn and accepted by all parties as the framework of a relationship, and relations are sufficiently ongoing that we're not simply dealing with arbitrary force, then relations will be seen as being regulated by a web of habit or custom. Sometimes the situation is assumed to have originated in some founding act of conquest, or it might have been seen as ancestral custom for which there is no need of explanation. But this introduces another complication to the problem of giving gifts to kings, or to any superior. There is always the danger that it will be treated as a precedent, added to the web of custom, and therefore considered obligatory thereafter. Xenophon claims that in the early days of the Persian Empire, Each province vied to send the great king gifts of its most unique and valuable products. This eventually became the basis of the tribute system. Each province was eventually expected to provide the same gifts every year. Similarly, according to the great medieval historian Mark Bloch, quote, in the 9th century, when one day there was a shortage of wine in the royal cellars at Vair, the monks of Saint-Denis were asked to supply the 200 hogsheads required. This contribution was thenceforth claimed from them as of right every year, and it required an imperial charter to abolish it. At Ardres, we are told, there was once a bear, the property of a local lord. The inhabitants, who loved to watch it fight with the dogs, undertook to feed it. The beast eventually died, but the lord continued to exact the loaves of bread. Unquote. In other words, any gift to a feudal superior, especially if repeated 3 or 4 times, was likely to be treated as a precedent and added to the web of custom. As a result, those giving gifts to superiors often insisted on receiving a letter of non-prejudice legally stipulating that such a gift would not be required in the future. While it is unusual for matters to become quite so formalized, any social relation that is assumed from the start to be unequal will inevitably begin to operate on an analogous logic, if only because, once relations are seen as based on custom, the only way to demonstrate that one has a duty or obligation to do something is to show that one has done it before. Often, such arrangements can turn into a logic of caste. Certain clans are responsible for weaving the ceremonial garments, or bringing the fish to royal feasts, or cutting the king's hair. They thus come to be known as weavers or fishermen or barbers. This last point can't be overemphasized, because it brings home another truth regularly overlooked, that the logic of identity is, always and everywhere, entangled in the logic of hierarchy. It's only when certain people are placed above others, or where everyone is being ranked in relation to the king, or the high priest, or founding fathers, that one begins to speak of people bound by their essential nature, about fundamentally different kinds of human being. Ideologies of caste or race are just extreme examples. It happens whenever one group is seen as raising themselves above others, or placing themselves below others, in such a way that ordinary standards of fair dealing no longer apply. In fact, something like this happens in a small way even in our most intimate social relations. The moment we recognize someone as a different sort of person, either above or below us, then ordinary rules of reciprocity become modified, or are set aside. If a friend is unusually generous once, we will likely wish to reciprocate. If she acts this way repeatedly, we conclude she is a generous person and are hence less likely to reciprocate. We can describe a simple formula here. A certain action, repeated, becomes customary. As a result, it comes to define the actor's essential nature. Alternately, a person's nature may be defined by how others have acted toward him in the past. To be an aristocrat is largely to insist that in the past others have treated you as an aristocrat. Since aristocrats don't really do anything in particular, mostly spend their time simply existing in some sort of putatively superior state, and therefore that you should continue to do so. Much of the art of being such a person is that of treating oneself in such a manner that it conveys how you expect others to treat you. In the case of actual kings, covering oneself with gold so as to suggest that others do likewise. On the other end of the scale, this is also how abuse becomes self-legitimating. As a former student of mine, Sarah Stillman, pointed out, in the United States, if a middle-class 13-year-old is kidnapped, raped, and killed, it's considered an agonizing national crisis that everyone with a television is expected to follow for several weeks. If a 13-year-old girl is turned out as a child prostitute, raped systematically for years, and ultimately killed, all this is considered unremarkable, really just the sort of thing that one can expect to end up happening to someone like that. When objects of material wealth pass back and forth between superiors and inferiors as gifts or payments, the key principle seems to be that the sort of things given on each side should be considered fundamentally different in quality, their relative value impossible to quantify, the result being that there is no way to even conceive of squaring accounts. even if medieval writers insisted on imagining society as a hierarchy in which priests would pray for everyone, nobles fight for everyone, and peasants feed everyone, it never even occurred to anyone to establish how many prayers or how much military protection was equivalent to a ton of wheat. Nor did anyone ever consider making such a calculation. Neither is it that lowly sorts of people are necessarily given lowly sorts of things and vice versa. Sometimes it's quite the opposite. Until recently, just about any notable philosopher, artist, poet, or musician was required to find a wealthy patron for support. Famous works of poetry or philosophy are often prefaced, oddly to the modern eye, with gushing, sycophantic praise for the wisdom and virtue of some long-forgotten earl or count who provided a meagre stipend. The fact that the noble patron merely provided room and board, or money, and that the client showed his gratitude by painting the Mona Lisa, or composing the Toccata, or the Fugue in D minor, was in no way seen to compromise the assumption of the noble's intrinsic superiority. There is one great exception to this principle, and that is the phenomenon of hierarchical redistribution. Here, though, rather than giving back and forth the same sorts of things, they give back and forth exactly the same thing, as, for instance, when fans of certain Nigerian pop stars throw money onto the stage during concerts, and the pop stars in question make occasional tours of their fans' neighborhoods tossing the same money from the windows of their limos. When this is all that's going on, we may speak of an absolutely minimal sort of hierarchy. In much of Papua New Guinea, social life centers on the big men, charismatic individuals who spend much of their life coaxing, cajoling, and manipulating in order to acquire masses of wealth to give away again at some great feast. One could, in practice, pass from here to, say, an Amazonian or indigenous North American chief. Unlike big men, their role is more formalized. But actually, such chiefs have no power to compel anyone to do anything they don't want to do. Hence, North American Indian chiefs' famous skill at oratory and powers of persuasion. As a result, they tended to give away far more than they'd received. Observers often remarked that in terms of personal possessions, a village chief was often the poorest man in the village. Such was the pressure on him for constant supply of largesse. Indeed, one could judge how egalitarian a society really was by exactly this, whether those ostensibly in positions of authority are merely conduits for redistribution, or able to use their positions to accumulate riches. The latter seems most likely in aristocratic societies that add another element, war and plunder. After all, just about anyone who comes into a very large amount of wealth will ultimately give at least part of it away, often in grandiose and spectacular ways to large numbers of people. The more of one's wealth is obtained by plunder or extortion, the more spectacular and self-aggrandizing will be the forms in which it's given away. And what's true of warrior aristocracies is all the more true of ancient states, where rulers almost invariably represented themselves as the protectors of the helpless, supporters of widows and orphans, and champions of the poor. The genealogy of the modern redistributive state, with its notorious tendency to foster identity politics, can be traced back not to any sort of primitive communism, but ultimately to violence and war. Shifting between modalities. I should underline here again that we're not talking about different types of society here. As we've seen, the very idea that we've ever been organized into discrete societies is dubious, but moral principles that always coexist everywhere. We're all communists with our closest friends and feudal lords when dealing with small children. It would be hard to imagine a society where people wouldn't be both. The obvious question is, if we are all ordinarily moving back and forth between completely different systems of moral accounting, why hasn't anyone noticed this? Why, instead, do we continually feel the need to reframe everything in terms of reciprocity? Here we must return to the fact that reciprocity is our main way of imagining justice. In particular, it's what we fall back on when we're thinking in the abstract, and especially when we're trying to create an idealized picture of society. I've already given examples of this sort of thing. Iroquois communities were based on an ethos that required everyone to be attentive to the needs of several different sorts of people, their friends, their families, members of their matrilineal clans, even friendly strangers in situations of hardship. It was when they had to think about society in the abstract that they started to emphasize the two sides of the village, each of which had to bury the other's dead. It was a way of imagining communism through reciprocity. Similarly, feudalism was a notoriously messy and complicated business, but whenever medieval thinkers generalized about it, they reduced all its ranks and orders into some sort of simple formula in which each order contributed its share. Some fight, some pray, still others work. Even hierarchy was seen as ultimately reciprocal, despite this formula having nothing to do with the real relations between priests, knights, and peasants as they operated on the ground. Anthropologists are familiar with the phenomenon. It's only when people who have never had occasion to really think about their society or culture as a whole, who probably weren't even aware that they were living inside something other people consider as a society or a culture, are asked to explain how everything works, that they say things like, "This is how we repay our mothers for the pain of having raised us," or puzzle over conceptual diagrams in which Clan A gives their women in marriage to Clan B, who give theirs to Clan C, who give theirs back to A again, but which never seem to quite correspond to what real people actually do. When trying to imagine a just society, it's hard not to evoke images of balance and symmetry, of elegant geometries where everything balances out. The idea that there is something called the market is not so very different. Economists will often admit this if you ask them in the right way. Markets aren't real. They're mathematical models, created by imagining a self-contained world where everyone has exactly the same motivation and the same knowledge and is engaging in the same self-interested calculating exchange. Economists are aware that reality is always more complicated, but they are also aware that to come up with a mathematical model, one has to make the world into a bit of a cartoon. There's nothing wrong with this. The problem comes when it enables some, often these same economists, to declare that anyone who ignores the dictates of the market shall surely be punished, or that since we live in a market system, everything, except government interference, is based on principles of justice. That our economic system is just one vast network of reciprocal relations in which, in the end, the accounts balance and all debts are paid. These principles get tangled up in each other, and it's often difficult to tell which predominates in a given situation. One reason that it's ridiculous to pretend we could ever reduce human behavior, economic or otherwise, to a mathematical formula of any sort. Still, this means that some degree of reciprocity can be detected as potentially present in any situation, so a determined observer can always find some excuse to say it's there. What's more, certain principles appear to have an inherent tendency to slip into others. For instance, a lot of extremely hierarchical relationships can operate, at least some of the time, on communistic principles. If you have a rich patron, you come to him in times of need, and he is expected to help you, but only to a certain degree. No one expects the patron to provide so much help that it threatens undermining the underlying inequality. Likewise, communistic relations can easily start slipping into relations of hierarchical inequality, often without anyone noticing it. It's not hard to see why this happens. Sometimes different people's abilities and needs are grossly disproportionate. Genuinely egalitarian societies are keenly aware of this and tend to develop elaborate safeguards around the dangers of anyone, say, especially good hunters in a hunting society, rising too far above themselves, just as they tend to be suspicious of anything that might make one member of society feel in genuine debt to another. A member who draws attention to his own accomplishments will find himself the object of mockery. Often the only polite thing to do, if one has accomplished something significant, is to instead make fun of oneself. The Danish writer, Peter Freuchen, in his Book of the Eskimo, described how in Greenland one could tell what a fine delicacy someone had to offer his guests by how much he belittled it beforehand. Quote, "The old man laughed. 'Some people don't know much. I am such a poor hunter, and my wife a terrible cook who ruins everything. I don't have much, but I think there is a piece of meat outside. It might still be there, as the dogs have refused it several times.'" This was such a recommendation in the Eskimo way of backwards bragging that everyone's mouths began to water. Unquote. The reader will recall the walrus hunter of the last chapter, who took offense when the author tried to thank him for giving him a share of the meat. After all, humans help one another, and once we treat something as a gift, we turn into something less than human. Up here, we say that by gifts one makes slaves, and by whips one makes dogs. A gift here does not mean something given freely, not mutual aid that we can ordinarily expect human beings to provide to one another. To thank someone suggests that he or she might not have acted that way, and that therefore the choice to act this way creates an obligation, a sense of debt, and hence inferiority. Communes or egalitarian collectives in the United States often face similar dilemmas, and they have to come up with their own safeguards against creeping hierarchy. It's not that the tendency for communism to slip into hierarchy is inevitable. Societies like the Inuit have managed to fend it off for thousands of years, but rather that one must always guard against it. In contrast, it's notoriously difficult, often downright impossible, to shift relations based on the assumption of communistic sharing to relations of equal exchange. We observe this all the time with friends. If someone is seen as taking advantage of your generosity, it's often much easier to break off relations entirely than to demand that they somehow pay you back. One extreme example is the Maori story about a notorious glutton who used to irritate the fishermen up and down the coast near where he lived by constantly asking for the best portions of their catch. Since to refuse a direct request for food was effectively impossible, they would dutifully turn it over, until one day people decided enough was enough and killed him. We've already seen how creating a ground of sociability among strangers can often require an elaborate process of testing the other's limits by helping oneself to their possessions. The same sort of thing can happen in peacemaking, or even in the creation of business partnerships. In Madagascar, people told me that two men who are thinking of going into business together will often become blood brothers. Blood brotherhood, fatidra, consists of an unlimited promise of mutual aid. Both parties solemnly swear that they will never refuse any request from the other. In reality, partners to such an agreement are usually fairly circumspect in what they actually request. But, my friends insisted, when people first make such an agreement, they sometimes like to test it out. One may demand the other's house, the shirt off his back, or, everyone's favourite example, the right to spend the night with his wife. The only limit is the knowledge that anything one can demand, the other can too. Here again, we are talking about an initial establishment of trust. Once the genuineness of the mutual commitment has been confirmed, the ground is prepared, as it were, and the two men can begin to buy and sell on consignment, advance funds, share profits, and otherwise trust that each will look after the other's commercial interests from then on. The most famous and dramatic moments, however, are those when relations of exchange threaten to break down into hierarchy. That is, when two parties are acting like equals, trading gifts or blows or commodities or anything else, but one of them does something that completely flips the scale. I've already mentioned the tendency of gift exchange to turn into games of one-upmanship, and how in some societies this potential is formalized in great public contests. This is typical, above all, of what are called heroic societies, those in which governments are weak or non-existent, and societies organized instead around warrior noblemen, each with his entourage of loyal retainers, and tied to the others by ever-shifting alliances and rivalries. Most epic poetry, from the Iliad to the Mahabharata to Beowulf, harkens back from this sort of world, and anthropologists have discovered similar arrangements among the Maori of New Zealand and the Kwiakutl, Tlingit, and Haida of the American northwest coast. In heroic societies, the throwing of feasts and resulting contests of generosity are often spoken of as mere extensions of war, fighting with property or fighting with food. Those who throw such feasts often indulge in colourful speeches about how their enemies are thus crushed and destroyed by glorious feats of generosity aimed in their direction. Kwiakutl chiefs like to speak of themselves as great mountains from which gifts rolled like giant boulders, and of how conquered rivals are thus reduced, much as in the Inuit metaphor, to slaves. Such statements are not to be taken literally. Another feature of such societies is a highly developed art of boasting. Heroic chiefs and warriors tended to talk themselves up just as consistently as those in egalitarian societies talk themselves down. It's not as if someone who loses out in a contest of gift exchange is ever actually reduced to slavery, but he might end up feeling as if he were. and the consequences could be catastrophic. One ancient Greek source describes Celtic festivals, where rival nobles would alternate between jousts and contests of generosity, presenting their enemies with magnificent gold and silver treasures. Occasionally this could lead to a kind of checkmate. Someone would be faced with a present so magnificent that he could not possibly match it. In this case, the only honourable response was for him to cut his own throat, thus allowing his wealth to be distributed to his followers. 600 years later, we find a case from the Icelandic saga of an ageing Viking named Egil, who befriended a younger man named Einar, who was still actively raiding. They liked to sit together composing poetry. One day, Einar came by a magnificent shield, inscribed with old tales, and between the writing were overlaid spangles of gold with precious stones. No one had ever seen anything like it. He took it with him on a visit to Egil. Egil was not at home, so Einar waited 3 days, as was the custom, then hung the shield as a present in the mead hall, and rode off. Egil returned home, saw the shield, and asked who owned such a treasure. He was told that Einar had visited him, and given it to him. Then Egil said, "To hell with him! Does he think that I'm going to stay up all night and compose a poem about his shield? Get my horse! I'm going to have to ride after him and kill him." As Einar's luck would have it, he'd left early enough to put sufficient distance between himself and Egil. So Egil resigned himself to composing a poem about Einar's gift. Competitive gift exchange does not literally render anyone slaves. It is simply an affair of honour. These are people, however, for whom honour is everything. The main reason that being unable to pay a debt, especially a debt of honour, was such a crisis was because of how noblemen assembled their entourages. The law of hospitality in the ancient world, for instance, insisted that any traveller must be fed, given shelter, and treated as an honoured guest, but only for a certain length of time. If a guest did not go away, he would eventually become a mere subordinate. The role of such hangers-on has been largely neglected by students of human history. In many periods, from imperial Rome to medieval China, probably the most important relationships, at least in towns and cities, were those of patronage. Anyone rich and important would find himself surrounded by flunkies, sycophants, perpetual dinner guests, and other sorts of willing dependents. The drama and poetry of the time are full of such characters. Similarly, for much of human history, being respectable and middle class meant spending one's mornings going from door to door, paying one's respects to important local patrons. To this day, informal patronage systems still crop up, whenever relatively rich and powerful people feel the need to assemble networks of supporters, a practice well documented in many parts of the Mediterranean, the Middle East, and Latin America. Such relationships seem to consist of a slapdash mix of all three principles that I've been mapping out over the course of this chapter. Nevertheless, those observing them insist on trying to cast them in a language of exchange and debt. A final example. In a collection called Gifts and Spoils, published in 1971, we find a brief essay by the anthropologist Lorraine Blackster about a rural development in the French Polynese, most of whose inhabitants are farmers. Everyone places a great emphasis on the importance of mutual aid. The local phrase means giving service, rendre service. People living in the same community should look out for one another and pitch in when the neighbours are having trouble. This is the essence of communal morality. In fact, it's how one knows that any sort of community exists. So far, so good. However, she notes, when someone does a particularly great favour, mutual aid can turn into something else. Quote, "If a man in a factory went to the boss and asked for a job, and the boss found him one, this would be an example of someone giving service. The man who got the job could never repay the boss, but he could show him respect, or perhaps give him symbolic gifts of garden produce. If a gift demands a return, and no tangible return is possible, the repayment will be through support or esteem." Unquote. Thus does mutual aid slip into inequality. Thus do patron-client relations come into being. We've already observed this. I chose this particular passage because the author's phrasing is so weird. It completely contradicts itself. The boss does the man a favour. The man cannot repay the favour. Therefore, the man repays the favour by showing up at the boss's house with an occasional basket of tomatoes and showing him respect. So, which one is it? Can he repay the favour or not? Peter Freuchen's walrus hunter would, no doubt, think he knew exactly what was going on here. Bringing the basket of tomatoes was simply a way of saying thank you. It was a way of acknowledging that one owes a debt of gratitude, that gifts had in fact made slaves, just as whips make dogs. The boss and the employee are now fundamentally different sorts of people. The problem is that in all other respects they're not fundamentally different sorts of people. Most likely they're both middle-aged Frenchmen, fathers of families, citizens of the Republic, with similar tastes in music, sports, and food. They ought to be equals. As a result, even the tomatoes, which are really a token of recognition of the existence of a debt that can never be repaid, has to be presented as if it was itself a kind of repayment, an interest payment on a loan that could, everyone agrees to pretend, someday be paid back, thus returning the two members to their proper equal status once again. It's telling that the favour is finding the client a job in a factory, because what happens is not very different from what happens when you get a job in a factory to begin with. A wage-labour contract is, ostensibly, a free contract between equals, but an agreement between equals in which both agree that once one of them punches the time clock, they won't be equals anymore. The law does recognise a bit of a problem here. That's why it insists that you cannot sell off your equality permanently. You are not free to sell yourself into slavery. Such arrangements are only acceptable if the boss's power is not absolute, if it's limited to work time, and if you have the legal right to break off the contract, and thereby to restore yourself to full equality, at any time. It seems to me that this arrangement between equals to no longer be equal, at least for a time, is critically important. It's the very essence of what we call debt. What then is debt? Debt is a very specific thing, and it arises from very specific situations. It first requires a relationship between two people who do not consider each other fundamentally different sorts of being, who are at least potential equals, who are equals in those ways that are really important, and who are not currently in a state of equality, but for whom there is some way to set matters straight. In the case of gift-giving, as we've seen, this requires a certain equality of status. That's why our economics professor didn't feel any sense of obligation, any debt of honour, if taken out to dinner by someone who ranked either much higher or much lower than himself. With money loans, all that is required is that the two parties be of equal legal standing. You can't lend money to a child or to a lunatic. Well, you can, but the courts won't help you get it back. Legal, rather than moral, debts have other unique qualities. For instance, they can be forgiven, which isn't always possible with a moral debt. This means that there is no such thing as a genuinely unpayable debt. If there was no conceivable way to salvage the situation, we wouldn't be calling it a debt. Even the French villager could, conceivably, save his patron's life, or win the lottery and buy the factory. Even when we speak of a criminal paying his debt to society, we are saying that he's done something so terrible that he's now been banished from that equal status under the law that belongs by natural right to any citizen of his country. However, we call it a debt because it can be paid. Equality can be restored, even if the cost may be death by lethal injection. During the time that the debt remains unpaid, the logic of hierarchy takes hold. There is no reciprocity. As anyone who's ever been in jail knows, the first thing the jailers communicate is that nothing that happens in jail has anything to do with justice. Similarly, debtor and creditor confront each other like a peasant before a feudal lord. The law of precedent takes hold.